Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon, where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge.
Welcome to the Connecting the Dots podcast with Dr. Wilmer Leon. I am Wilmer Leon. Here's the point. You know, we have a tendency to view current events as though they occur in a vacuum, failing to see the broader historical context in which events take place. During each episode of this program, my guests and I have probing, provocative, and in-depth discussions that connect the dots between current events and the broader historic context in which they occur. This enables you to better understand and analyze the events that impact the global village in which we live. On today's episode, the issue before us is the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, and why does the United States keep throwing good taxpayer dollars after bad? To discuss this, we are joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's a Moscow-based international relations and security analyst. Mark, as always, welcome back.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Connecting the Dots.
So it's been reported that an attack on a convoy of Ukrainian military equipment in the Donetsk People's Republic was carried out with the use of short-range ballistic missiles. And it also seems as though with all of this hand-wringing in the U.S. Congress about funding for Ukraine, all the U.S. and NATO is doing or seems to be doing is sending more targets for Russia to destroy. Your thoughts, Mark?
Yeah, there are some rather dramatic developments, really underreported in the Western press, that have very large implications going forward for the conflict in Ukraine, the current situation on the ground. I think the Western mainstream media has finally, their propaganda narrative bubble has finally burst, right? Look at in a span of how short a period of time we have gone from Ukraine is winning to stalemate. It's a stalemate on the battlefield to, oh my God, we're losing to Nigeria with snow. I mean, that's the rather dramatic change in the propaganda narrative. And I think we can see it reflected in the political elite as well, with the panic and desperation that is starting to sit in and become rather obvious among European leaders who really have the most to lose from this conflict, rather than other than the Kiev regime in Ukraine itself. And this all occurs, these latest incidents, in the final weeks of and the aftermath of the Russian breakthrough of the Kiev regime's most heavily fortified fortress city. These extensive defenses and fortifications, trenches, concrete bunkers, pillboxes, networks of tunnels, layers of minefields, you name it, in Avdiivka, which is really quite close to Donetsk City. And a Western journalist a couple of years ago already referred to it rather poetically, quite awfully, as a knife pointed at the heart of Donetsk. They meant that in a good way. Another way of course, looking at it was a jackboot pressed to the neck of the people of Donbass, because it is from Avdiivka and the settlements shielded behind it that the Kiev regime forces brutally shelled the people of Donetsk for the last decade, pretty much. With regularly, and they didn't shell military facilities, they shelled civilian areas with artillery, with cluster munitions, with petrol mines. And this was to punish the people of Donbass for choosing wrong, for not accepting the overthrow of the government by the West-backed Maidan Putsch back in 2014. And, you know, with the intention that it of driving Russian ethnic people who did not accept the new Ukraine into Russia. That was the intention and one of the primary reasons for the Russian intervention in the Ukrainian civil conflict. Not the only one. There were security concerns as well, but this was loudly voiced as well. And when the Russians broke through Avdiivka, they did it rather dramatically towards the end. It ended up much shorter than, say, the siege of Bakhmut, despite the defenses in Avdiivka being considerably stronger. And this is because of a sea change on the battlefield. The Kiev regime's initial air integrated Soviet legacy air defense network, the backbone of which was the formidable S-300 systems, had been largely deteriorated at this point already a few months ago. And on top of what hadn't been destroyed, they were absolutely out of interceptor missiles for it, and there were none left in countries that are now part of the West, former Eastern Bloc countries. Their supplies were all exhausted. So there was an attempt to put together a hodgepodge piecemeal air defense system, not properly integrated with using Western systems. But that has also been attrited away over the last few months. Russia launched an extensive campaign over the winter, and that was a primary target of their missile and drone campaign. So in Avdiivka, Russia fully unleashed the FAB-guided glide bombs on these defenses. And these are old dumb munitions with smart glide kits that turned them into precision weapons, being able to fire from air at a distance of tens of kilometers. And because these are bombs, not artillery shells, they have a considerably bigger payload. They come in 500, 1,000, and 1,500 kilogram capacities. And they just annihilate. I mean, if the Kiev regime turns, say, what they did, you know, pretty much to every building in the city, turning it into a mini fortress that has to be individually stormed, one FAB bomb, and it's gone. And particularly at the larger end, the 1500, they have an incredibly demoralizing effect on anyone within, you know, the radius of experiencing the explosion, the concussion, and the like. And they, in the closing days of Avdiivka, according to the Russian Ministry of Defense, they dropped over 500 of these.
Oh my God.
The fortresses in just the last few days, right? So that's why they collapsed so quickly and dramatically at the end, and why there was such a rout. And they're able to do this now because they can fly with a considerable degree of impunity over the battlefield, because first the Soviet legacy and now the Western air defense system sent as a replacement have largely been destroyed. And immediately in the aftermath of Avdiivka, the Russian forces, far from being exhausted, as many Western military analysts drinking their own propaganda Kool-Aid tried to claiming high casualties, as they always do without any evidence to back it up, other than the say-so of the regime in Kiev. Russian forces were not exhausted because they had not suffered any considerable attrition, because they had been standing off and dropping an extremely large bombs from Su-34s, from fighter bombers on Avdiivka, which is what did, at least at the end, the majority of their work for them once they were already ensconced in the outskirts of the city. So they continued on fallback positions in the next line of villages that Kiev regime forces had retreated to, and were, you know, hastily trying to dig themselves in because they had not built proper defenses. And for instance, Lastichka and Severna lasted 2 or 3 days. And as Russia moved on the second line of villages even further, and we faced a real breakthrough in the Kiev regime defensive lines at this point, the Kiev regime became desperate to try to at least slow down. We're not even talking stop, but to slow down the Russian advance to give themselves more time to hastily dig, as the Western headlines have now been talking about the, you know, what the Kiev regime needs to do to dig new trenches, to dig new fortifications. So they moved a large number of what air defense systems they had left elsewhere in the country into an area far too close to the battlefield. And Russia at this point, not only, of course, enjoys air superiority over the contact line, but they also enjoy drone superiority. And Russia has put a rather larger number of military satellites into the orbit in the last few months that have started to come online. So they were able to track these air defense systems fairly well. And it's more than just three Patriot launchers that have been destroyed. Also, one of the remaining older S-300 air defense systems, several NASAMS air defense systems supplied by the U.S. and Norway, and also a number of Buks and smaller systems. By my count, at least 11 air defense systems have been destroyed in the last 2 weeks over the area immediately to the west of Avdiivka. And this is adding to the butcher's bill. Previously, the Kiev regime has adopted a new tactic in several areas. We saw it over the Sea of Azov. We saw it also in Belgorod, where that Il-76 transport plane shot down, the Kiev regime shot down its own plane full of prisoners of war a couple of months ago, if you remember. And then forced to admit it. They've been sending, in an attempt to try to stop the Russian dominance of the skies, they've tried to use essentially not mobile air defense systems in a mobile capacity to set up ambushes for Russian planes to instill a degree of caution and restraint. But that has proven very costly for them. Because they've also lost air defense systems in that way as well, because, of course, Russia was actively hunting them down. And despite their claims to have shot down large numbers of Russian aircraft, there is zero evidence providing this. Zero. I mean, and there have been plenty of evidence, for instance, of the Kiev regime's own aircraft, remaining aircraft being shot down. When they're shot down, there is video footage, there's air wreckage, and the like. So really questionable claims. They may have sacrificed, other than this, of course, the POW plane, which everyone noticed.
Right.
But that was an undefended transport plane flying in what it assumed, you know, a mission of peace, you know, bringing POWs for an exchange. So they've lost a huge degree of whatever hodgepodge air defense they had left. Now, Forbes, speaking just of the events in Avdiivka, not of the rest of it, says that just in those engagements that the Kiev regime lost 13% of its air defense capacity, speaking specifically of the Patriot systems provided to it. And that's on paper, because they're not acknowledging earlier Patriot systems that have been shot down. So I would suggest that they have at this point lost far more. They probably have a number of Patriot launchers in the single digits left in Kiev, for instance, possibly in Odessa. But the implications of this going forward is that Russian air use of air superiority, and even now close air support over the contact line, is going to dramatically increase, because there is no air defense left to deal with them, which means the pace of Russian advances are going to increase. And this is when even Western analysts and Ukrainians are talking about rather large concentrations of Russian forces behind the lines that have been built up but not committed yet. Mm-hmm. And there is the suspicion that they're going to launch a large-scale Big Arrow offensive sometime later this year. In fact, the Kiev regime has just in the past week evacuated the entirety of Kharkov region, some 85 wow. settlements, ordered the civilian evacuation because they fear a big offensive in the Kharkov direction in the coming probably months, perhaps weeks.
President Biden told us during his State of the Union address that Ukraine can stop Putin. Ukraine can stop Putin if we stand with Ukraine and provide the weapons that it needs to defend itself. That's all. He says, in fact, there are no American soldiers at war in Ukraine. My question is, who's operating these U.S. supplied Patriot air defense systems? And are there U.S. Special Forces trainers that are on the ground training these forces?
Okay, so first to the last point, Joe Biden is lying. You know, Genocide Joe is flat up lying. We know it because the Western mainstream media has told us already in the summer of 2022 in the New York Times and the Washington Post, talking about unusually large numbers of U.S. intelligence and U.S. and European commandos on the ground in Ukraine. Then later we heard there were hundreds of uniformed U.S. troops on the ground, again from the Western mainstream media, mm-hmm. that were doing tracking of Western supplied weapons. Now, if that's really what they were doing, then they weren't doing a very good job, because it was only weeks after that we heard that the West couldn't track these weapons at all. So, I mean, either they were completely incompetent or they are doing something else on the ground.
Wait a minute. Aren't these the same stories that a lot of these weapons are showing up in other battles in other countries?
Yes. Okay. With the idea that a tithe, essentially, of Western weapons is being sold through corruption in the Ukrainian military and the distribution networks off because of the prevalent corruption in the country to pad their own pockets. And I don't think there's anything question about that. The Western mainstream media has long reported about that. In fact, early on, CBS noted that 70% of the weapons supplied by the West were not reading the front lines. This was early on in the conflict. So on top of those commandos, the Russian government has long complained that these high-tech systems supplied by the West, from the U.S. in particular, the HIMARS and multiple launch rocket systems and the Patriot air defense systems, as well as some French air defense systems, Polish Crab artillery systems, British Storm Shadows, cruise missiles, that these are all being operated by Western military specialists, right, who are being sent there under the guise of mercenaries or humanitarian aid workers and the like, because it is impossible to train the Kiev regime forces in such a short period of time to operate these advanced Western systems. The Russian government's been saying this for a considerable amount of time, but this was confirmed by no less a person than the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, who in an apparent spat back and forth with the French leader, Emmanuel Macron, and to the British as well, when the British were pressuring Germany to deliver the Taurus missiles, the context of Olaf Scholz is, we can't do what the British, the French, and the Americans are doing. And have people obliquely, he admitted that the West had their military forces on the ground operating their systems, and that Germany could not be seen as doing that. And this was reinforced in these leaked military calls from the German Air Force planning a series of cruise missile attacks inside Russia, with the expected to be delivered Taurus cruise missile system, at least expected by them. Mm-hmm. The political elites in Germany aren't saying that, but they also revealed that the German cruise missiles could perhaps be operated on the ground by the rather large number of Americans, of people on the ground, wearing civilian clothes with American accents, which of course is a roundabout way of saying U.S. military personnel not in uniform on the ground in Ukraine. So
they,
I mean,
they just happen to be tourists from Kansas that are in are wandering the fields and the steppe of Germany and Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, they're not wearing boots; they're wearing ballet slippers or figure skates or something, I guess. So that's a lie. Second of all, the Kiev regime can defeat. Well, Ukraine can beat Putin, right? The childish way that Western leaders and media kind of try to demonize any opponent down to just one leader and so forth. But if that was true, if Western military aid in Ukrainian Kiev regime hands was enough to beat Russia, then what happened over their failed summer counteroffensive? That was armed, trained, financed, intelligenced, planned, and war gamed out by NATO, primarily U.S. By the Pentagon, right? You know, that's who did it. They failed. They failed badly. They were mauled. They never even got past the first of Russia's five echelon defensive lines and suffered horrible casualties in the process. No one denies that. So there is no indication that, however additional tens of billions of dollars of aid are sent, that the West will ever again be able to build an offensive force like they did for Ukraine in the summer offensive, because they simply don't have the weapons in inventory to replace everything like that. They do have some things. They got plenty of Bradleys if they wanted. They don't, obviously, they're very reticent to allow the rather small number of Abrams that they've sent to be used in combat. Four of them have been destroyed after just appearing on the battlefield in the last week. The rest of the Western militaries that supplied weapons, they're tapped out. France, Germany, Denmark, the United Kingdom, they've all said, we can't supply anymore because we've already dug in past our stockpiles into our own military supplies, and we can't replace these systems fast enough. For instance, one French Caesar self-propelled howitzer, a total of 36 of these between France and Denmark were supplied to the Kiev regime, you know, for the course of that offensive. And they're practically through all of them. They have very few of them left because Russia's been hunting them down. And also they are subjected to considerable wear and tear, and they're not actually built for high intensity combat like this, much like the US's M777s and the Paladins and the like. But it takes the French 18 months, the French military industrial complex, 18 months to build one.
That's a year and a half.
One Caesar. But we heard that they have shortened that time to 15 months.
Oh, wow, that makes me feel a whole lot better. You just mentioned the leaked recordings from the German Air Force, and is it a coincidence that after these conversations were leaked, where the Germans were talking about taking out bridges in Russia with cruise missiles, that Victoria Nuland resigns, because there are some who say that her name was mentioned in these on these tapes, and that the German Air Force officers were really talking about conversations either they had with her or ideas that she was presenting about these attacks inside Russia.
Yeah, there's a possibility there. If that is the situation, then it appears that she was probably forced out by the Biden administration. But there are other, I think there are other considerations in play.
Okay.
Victoria Nuland, you know, the queen neocon of the U.S. She's married to Robert Kagan, who is the arch neocon of the United States. Robert Kagan, his books, you know, check them out if you're unfamiliar with his sinister work, I would say. She has long dominated through several presidencies U.S. policy towards Ukraine. She was instrumental in the actual West-backed Maidan putsch, if not the key architect of it. She was caught on recordings with then U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Piat talking about how they needed to midwife this thing, bring then Obama's Vice President Joe Biden in to midwife it, picking the new Prime Minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, from the leaders, the figurehead leaders of the Maidan, and then famously saying F the EU when the idea that the Europeans might want someone else for Ukraine's next prime minister was presented. So, I mean, she's been instrumental, and she briefly left office during the Trump administration and then came right back. She has been serving as Undersecretary for Political Affairs, which, despite the rather Kafkaesque bureaucratic name, is actually the third highest official within the U.S. Department of War. I'm sorry, not the U.S. Department of War, U.S. Department of State. My bad.
I can understand the confusion.
I said the difference, yeah. She, third highest official, and she was actually operating as the second highest official, just below the Secretary of State, for about a half of year when Wendy Sherman, the previous Deputy Secretary of State, stepped down. So she was doing the number two and number three job. Mm-hmm. And it was widely expected that she would be permanently assigned to that position, permanently elevated to Deputy Secretary of State. But we found out that just a month ago, she was passed over for this position by Kirk Campbell. The Biden approved someone else. And Kirk Campbell is an Asia specialist. He's a specialist on China. Which to my mind tells me that the Biden administration is tiring of this conflict in Ukraine and they're already looking past it, despite the bad situation their proxy regime is in to China, which may indicate a planned change of policy or at least prioritization, or at the very least an unwillingness to escalate further. I say may.
So does that mean then that the Biden administration is now following along the previous Obama administration's tilt towards Asia?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I believe that's what the Biden administration always wanted to do.
Okay. Right?
They wanted the Middle East to remain quiet. And it was not a priority for them. That didn't go out down so well. Just a week before the October 7th launching of the Al-Aqsa flood operation by Hamas on Israel, Jake Sullivan was in an essay talking about how nice and quiet the Middle East was, which allowed the U.S. to concentrate on other areas. Well, that didn't go so well then, since then. But they wanted the Middle East to be quiet. They expected to finish off Russia quickly. They expected their sanctions to destroy the Russian economy, Putin to be overthrown, and because of the economic immiseration of the country.
Boy, they wrong.
Yeah, and that they would now, their biggest concern would be dividing up Russia into smaller pieces and how to go about that. That appears to have been their plan. Okay, so not so good on the plan thing. But then they hoped to, they thought that would be finished quickly, and then to pivot hard to China. I think that was always their plan, to finish Russia off quickly, ignore the Middle East, and pivot hard to China. And none of that, of course, has gone according to plan. So with A and B having failed, they're trying to go to C anyway in very likely the months at this point that they have remaining to them. And I think that the passing over of Victoria Nuland for that is a sign that the Biden administration has already lost interest, possibly due to inability to achieve their desired goals, and is shifting to the next goals that they can't probably accomplish even more so, I would say, if they think that they're going to defeat China in some type of conflict off of their own coast in the Taiwan Straits and South China Sea. But anyway, I expect that Victoria Nuland was extremely unhappy about being passed over. She can see the bureaucratic writing on the wall, that the prioritization is changing away from, you know, her reason for existence, which is fighting Russia. And I think that probably at least as much, if not more so, played a role in her deciding to quit or being forced out. You know, we don't know the real truth of that yet, although I imagine that she won't be able to keep her mouth shut forever on that score.
or her husband. So Politico reports that France finds Baltic allies in its spat with Germany over Ukraine troop deployment, that France is building up an alliance of countries to open potentially that are open to potentially sending Western troops to Ukraine. That, Mark, sounds to me like there's a lot of tension within NATO. And going again back to President Biden's State of the Union, he told us America is a founding member of NATO, the military alliance of democratic nations, and that to prevent war, we've made NATO even stronger, which is the point that I was trying to get to about this element of his speech, that we've made NATO even stronger. And now he also assigns or attributes Finland joining NATO as evidence of NATO's strength. It doesn't sound like it's all good in Mudville.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, Hungary and Slovakia, of course, are the most egregious examples of this, because they are completely against, the proxy war now being fought on Russia in Ukraine completely. They won't have anything to do with it. But yeah, there are definitely, I think, tensions and cracks emerging and a bit of a panicked blame game going on right now, with different European countries all trying to blame each other, saying you haven't done enough. And with Macron coming out now, right, in the aftermath of the taking of Avdiivka, coming out and openly talking about putting NATO troops on the ground. I think this is not something that is a secret, something that has not been discussed for, and something that contingency plans are not already in place to do in the future. They just aren't in a political situation to have it said out loud now. I think that's the real problem that Germany and other countries have. It's causing them, no one is ready to do it now. And the fact that it has been brought up now, they see as politically detrimental to them in their own countries,
as in the farmers protests in Germany,
in Poland.
Okay,
yes, Poland. Yeah, I mean, there are protests across Europe,
right?
But Also, the fragile coalition government in Germany, the rise of the AfD, the alternative for Germany, the alternative for Deutschland, party in Germany. These are all blowback from the European involvement in the conflict in Ukraine. And they just did not need this now. I think Macron has pointed out two things. One is that levels of escalation in this conflict, you know, red lines that we will not cross in terms of escalation, have been passed again and again and again. I remember back in February and March of 2022, when Joe Biden saying that U.S. tanks and jets U.S. would never supply tanks and jets to Ukraine because that would mean World War III.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But U.S. tanks are now burning right in the urban agglomerations of the Donetsk region. U.S. F-16s are supposedly on their way within the next couple of months to the Kiev regime. So again and again, these lines have been crossed, and I believe this line will be crossed eventually, but not yet. And
okay.
Macron, the second point, and Macron pointed this out, right, that mm-hmm. what we once thought was, you know, unacceptable has become, you know, normal operations repeatedly during this conflict. As they've crawled further up or down the escalation ladder, however you choose to look at it. He also then made a point that when French troops might be sent into Ukraine, when Russian forces move on Kiev or Odessa, which is most likely some time away, probably more than a year, maybe longer than that.
Okay.
Right now fighting, Russia has a lot of advantages on the battlefield, but mm-hmm. big advances can still be measured in a handful of kilometers, a tree line, a small village, you know.
Okay.
The writing is on the wall in terms of the logistics of a war of attrition and everything, but mm-hmm. I think there's still a lot of hard ground slogging into the future. Macron sees that as well. So they're panicking now. I think he's right that when Russia moves towards Kiev or Odessa, there will be probably greater support for his suggestions. But we've already seen support from the Baltics. The Baltic leaders have come out and mm-hmm. said, yes, we're ready to send the handful of troops that we have now, because if there's anything the Baltics country need is to come out on the losing end of this conflict, having sent their own troops to war with Russia and having a NATO either fall apart or turned into a toothless tiger as a result of this. Really, really bad geopolitical move to my mind. Because they're, of course, the most vulnerable. They've got large populations of Russian ethnic populations that they have been rather seriously politically and linguistically, culturally repressing, particularly over the last 2 years,
mm-hmm.
Even trying to expel as many Russian ethnic people from their countries as they can, practically inviting, some type of Russian backed efforts against those governments in the Baltics. Really not a smart move. But also, Poland has made the Polish foreign minister, Sikorski, back again, mm-hmm. by the way, has also seemed to suggest, contrary to statements by the Polish president, that at some point down the line, Polish troops could be sent into Ukraine. And also Canada. Justin Trudeau has also volunteered Canadian troops as well in non-combat roles, of course, because that's what you do with your military troops. You send them into a conflict zone
as non-combatants.
As non-combat, you know, like trainers. First, you have trainers and advisors, then you have non-combat. We know, you know, the way this goes. So obviously, there is already, and check. The Czech president has also suggested He is a former NATO official himself, a very big hawk on Russia, and he has also hedged his words and seemed to suggest that Czech might be able to consider it. So these are countries who are already coming out, and we're just past Avdiivka, which is really only about 12 kilometers away from Donetsk City, right? I mean, there's a lot more to come, and the panic and desperation will increase. And I think Macron will definitely find more countries down the road when it becomes completely impossible to deny, as it will become in the future, you know, the writing on the wall that the Kiev regime cannot hold militarily. The New York Times has already talked about the possibility, and I think it's a very strong possibility, of later this year cascading collapses along the Kiev regime's defensive lines. Not me, but the New York Times has raised that as is, you know, talking to you know, anonymous Western military intelligence analysts about the probable course of the Ukrainian battlefield over the next half a year.
We mentioned Sweden joining NATO, and Finland has joined NATO. And we know about the very strong and robust social programs that those countries have, because they up until this point have had a position of neutrality in conflict, which means they haven't had to send the public resources over to a defense budget. Now that that seems to be changing, are we looking at Finland and Sweden as having to shift those resources? We now see more neocon policy, as well as what we'll call austerity measures. Can we expect austerity measures to creep their way into social policy in Finland and in Sweden?
Yeah, inevitably. I think we've already seen it to a certain degree. They've already, of course, suffered heavy economic consequences from their own sanctions on Russia, probably more significant than have been experienced by the Russian economy. Finland, in particular, did a very good cross-border business. I was on the Finnish-Russian border just a year ago at a kind of a wilderness vacation place on the border there. And well, actually, a couple of years ago before the conflict, very nice. And it was normal to cross the border from Russia and Finland to go to the store. For instance, someone had this better, someone had that better. And there was a great deal of cross-border business that has immensely suffered as a result, already hurting the Finnish economy. The Swedes have suffered the same thing, perhaps to a lesser degree, but without sharing an open border, but experienced it as well. And now, I mean, they've exhausted a great deal. Finland and Sweden have both provided outsized military resources to the Kiev regime already, and those resources, like so much else, are largely gone. They're either up in smoke piltered away in the Kiev regime's corruption. So on tops of the Kiev regime, of course, loudly demanding more, they also have to replenish their own military stocks. And now they have to militarize their own borders, which were unmilitarized, particularly in the case of Finland, which has a very large border. It was demilitarized. It was not a militarized border. There was police presence, but it was not a militarized border. That is now changing. And of course, facing the prospect of Finland joining NATO and U.S. forces on Finnish soil, Russia has reordered, completely changed military districting on the border there, and provided tens of thousands of new troops to be placed on the border, having to potentially deal with U.S. troops being stationed in Finland, as defensive contingencies. Finland is going to bear an increased burden with military. I do not see how this makes them more secure than they were before. I mean, they weren't targeted with nuclear missiles, and now they will be. I guess that is the price of joining the cool Western kids club in NATO, which it seems that the Finnish political elite wanted more than, you know, not creating economic and military problems with their much larger, you know, southern neighbor.
I read a story recently that elite units of Ukrainian armed forces are discussing overthrowing Zelensky. Is that a rumor? Any traction of that story there in Moscow? And your any insight into commanders and soldiers in elite units of the Ukrainian armed forces? They're dissatisfied with the reshuffling of the leadership, and they're talking about ousting Volodymyr Zelensky.
Yeah, when Zelensky got rid of Zaluzhny, and let's be clear, this didn't happen because of his military failures on the battlefield. It was done for political reasons, because he saw Zaluzhny as a threat, as possibly running for president himself or staging a military coup. And the possibility, there were plenty of signs that the U.S. was actually for a time considering switching horses. Which is why he forbade elections in Ukraine, citing the martial law, emergency powers, and so that he didn't have to face Zaluzhny in an election, which the polls say he would have lost, because Zaluzhny has more support in the country than he does.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he didn't only get rid of Zaluzhny. He got rid of whole streams of top down to low level commanders who were seen as loyal to Zaluzhny. There was a huge reshuffling or you know, replacement of Ukrainian, of the Kiev regime's military leaders as a result of this. There's a lot of embittered military people because of this. We don't need to look in secret Telegram chat rooms to hear this discussion. Because
which is where this story is was originally attributable.
Yes, this story is sourced from here, but there have already been open public statements by Kiev regime military commanders on the battlefield saying to the Ukrainian journalists, you know, this is wrong. There was a list signed by hundreds of Ukrainian military commanders serving on the battlefield, a petition asking Zelensky to get rid of Sirsky, whom he chose to replace Zelensky, whom is known as the butcher by his own forces, not because of the opponents that he kills, but because of his careless attitude towards the lives of his own people.
Not a good moniker. You don't, as a commander, you don't want your own forces seeing you as in the light of butchering them.
Yeah. I mean, my military experience tells me that that would not be the type of military commander that I wanted, certainly. And I seriously doubt that they do as well. Plus Sirsky is actually ethnic Russian. He was born in Russia, in the Soviet Union. His family still lives in Russia, and they're actually quite Russian patriotic. So it's a rather bizarre situation. And in many ways, there's a lot
makes
of
makes for a tough Christmas
here.
Dinner.
I don't think it makes for a Christmas dinner at all. I'm pretty sure. There are definitely parallels with the U.S. Civil War to be drawn there, and with so many other families across Russia and Ukraine. They made demands of Zelensky, public demands that they bring back Zaluzhny and get rid of Sirsky. And of course, that was ignored, and large numbers of those commanders were replaced. But if they're discussing it openly, and he's already taking this vengeful action against them, there's no great surprise that they are talking about it in what they believe to be secret chat rooms about, you know, taking it into their own hands. It's rather interesting, of course, that the Russian intelligence chose to make this public, because if they have penetrated this chat room, you can be totally sure that the Kiev regime's military intelligence, let's say Kirill Budanov, loyal to Zelensky, has penetrated this as well. And by going public with it, Russia might be forcing Zelensky's hand to take action against these coup plotting, even if it's in the very nascent, we hate this guy, why can't we, get rid of him, stage, of, shall we say, trash talk. It might be forcing Zelensky's hand to take action now, probably because Russia sees Zelensky and Syrsky in charge of the Kiev regime's political and military as far better for them than Zaluzhny, whom was not a brilliant military commander, but perhaps not an entirely incompetent one either.
Switching gears, the Cradle is reporting U.S. proxies fear Afghan-style withdrawal from Syria. The Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, they're fearing that their U.S. patrons will abandon them in favor of closer ties with Turkey. What's happening here with the U.S. military, their Kurdish proxies occupying northeast Syria and fearing a Afghan-like pullout? Is that a serious cause for concern?
I mean, that has been a serious cause for concern since 2016, right? The Kurds have been thrown, different Kurds, but Kurds have been thrown under the bus by the U.S. government after having been turned into proxies again and again by the United States, right? In Iraq, multiple times, in Syria previously against Turkey.
Going all the way back to H.W. Bush.
Throwing
the Kurds under the bus.
Yes. It's primary routine, which really amazes me that Kurds keep willing to be U.S. proxies when they see the long history, not just of the U.S. abandoning proxies, like, say, in Afghanistan, but the U.S. specifically abandoning Kurdish proxies before. And abandoning these same Kurdish proxies when Turkey advanced into northern Syria. They still, of course, control northern Syria, while the U.S. illegally military occupies east Syria. They just withdrew their forces and said, we're not going to defend you. Sorry, you should probably pull back or the Turks will wipe you up. I mean, that has already happened. The Turks regard the SDF as the YPG, the Syrian branch of the PKK, which is opposed to the Turkish government and fighting for the cause of a Kurdish ethnic nation state that would have to be carved out of parts of Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and perhaps Iran. They are the biggest ethnic people in the world that do not have a nation state. And it was inevitable that at some point, if the U.S. failed to overthrow the government in Damascus with their jihadi regime change, that they would at some point leave East Syria. And they haven't done so yet. And despite the rumors to the contrary, I don't expect them to do so in the near future. But it is inevitable at some point, right? You can't maintain an open-ended occupation of a very large amount of territory forever, all right, despite sitting on the Syria's valuable oil and wheat fields, preventing the economic stabilization of the country, seemingly out of spite, geopolitical spite, if nothing else. You can't maintain this forever, especially with the increase in the number of attacks on U.S. bases in Syria and Iraq from local resistance groups like Kataib Hezbollah, who don't want the U.S. occupying their countries, right? Meaning Syria and Iraq. There's certainly a cost that has to be paid there, but the cost is still not extremely high. And Biden, already being seen as responsible for the disastrous Vietnam-style withdrawal from Afghanistan, leading the Taliban to completely retake the country in rather embarrassing fashion. He does not want to be seen the same role in Syria, I think. Certainly not in the next year, perhaps if he wins re-election against all odds, then there might be a possibility in his next administration. But a word of warning, if we do see Biden moving troops out of Syria and Iraq, the reason would probably be that they intend to strike Iran, and they're moving their forces out of the range of Iranian ballistic missiles that would target them if that happened. There's a history of U.S. withdrawals preceding attacks elsewhere. When the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, we found out later from the U.S. Secretary of State that withdrawing from Afghanistan allowed the U.S. To provide the resources to the regime, the Kiev regime in Ukraine, that they would not have been able to do otherwise. So it seems that they already had intentions towards that regard. So watch it. If Biden does pull out of Syria, it may not actually be good for the Syrians or for anyone else in the region. It might actually be a signal that the U.S. intends to escalate towards Iran.
Is there a possibility in terms of signaling here that we look at, of course, Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah is now talking about escalating in terms of coming through Lebanon. If this thing were to grow even more, conflagrate even more, bringing Iran in, you've got Ansar Allah in the game. Does Syria get in the game as well? And so could the United States move out of Syria, be in preparation for a larger conflagration of that nature?
Yeah, I don't see that. Okay. First of all, I think the U.S. and Iran are still doing everything possible to avoid direct conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. Hence the stand down by Kataib Hezbollah saying they wouldn't attack U.S. military bases any further. And it is actually Israel who is talking about escalating against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. I think the U.S. and Iran are both doing everything they can to maintain their state's dignity and still dance around each other, avoiding direct conflict in the Middle East. That said, Israel is doing everything possible to incite conflict between the U.S. and Iran, which makes that a non-guarantee. But the Syrian government is in a very weak position. They economically, the U.S. is still illegally occupying the entirety of the east of the country, including the country's oil and wheat resources. The country is, the government is unstable. It's economic, very hard times. And Turkey is still occupying the entirety of the north of the country. And they still have 100,000 jihadis under arms occupying those territories in northern Syria. And of course the U.S. military occupation forces, alongside the Kurdish YPG, in East Syria. The Syrian government is in no geopolitical or military shape to contribute to a fight. I do not see this blowing up because no one wants to go to war with the U.S. over Gaza. No one, except for our Ansar.
Final question for you. The United States, relative to Syria, developing stronger ties with Turkey. How can the U.S. make rapprochement in this manner when Erdogan is so erratic and undependable?
Yeah, I don't think they can.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think Erdogan has become a perennial thorn in their side that they constantly need to keep appeased to prevent him from, shall we say, flipping into the Russian BRICS Eurasian camp. Mm-hmm. And Erdogan routinely plays the U.S. and Russia off of each other. to what he sees as his country's advantage. The U.S. support of the Kurds in East Syria, of course, has infuriated him, as has the U.S. withdrawal of the F-35 program from Turkey when Erdogan bought the S-400 air defense system from
Russia.
Yes, from Russia. He also regards the U.S. as at least being, if not complicit, then at least having knowledge of the coup attempt against him several years ago. Mm-hmm. Very bad relations there. The U.S. cannot rely on Turkey. And Turkey, well, it sees itself as being betrayed by the United States. I don't see any ability to improve relations between the two until there is regime change, perhaps in the United States, but more than likely it will require Erdogan passing on one way or another for a substantial change in Turkish-U.S. relations.
I know I said that was my last question, but this is my last question. Since you mentioned the coup in Turkey a few years ago, Gulen is still, I believe, somewhere in Pennsylvania at a property in Pennsylvania. Are you surprised that he has not been turned over to Turkey as a way of appeasing Erdogan? And do you think Gulen can be fairly confident that he's not going to be turned over as a fig leaf for better relations?
Yeah, I think the U.S. constantly sees him as a bit of leverage. The U.S. likes to keep shadow governments in place for just about every country in the world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in the United States, leaders, you know, forces.
The Shah's son is still roaming around Northern Virginia.
The Shah's son, Joe Biden, just declared Yulia Navalnaya, and then Yolanda, whoever she is, to be the new leader of the Russian opposition. You know, you've got Juan Guaido still out there. You mm-hmm. know, this is actually absolutely normal. There are entire communities outside Langley that are just exist of U.S. backed shadow governments ready, mm-hmm. waiting to be installed in foreign countries. But I have to say that I don't actually think the Gulen movement had anything to do with the coup against Erdogan that mm-hmm. occurred several years ago. This was almost entirely a military attempt to restore a Kemalist state in Turkey against Erdogan's Islamism. It was just sprung early by the Turkish government under what it believed to be controlled conditions. And then rather than admitting a secular Islamist divide in the country, they simply blamed it on a convenient scapegoat, which was, the Falun Gong. So I don't think that he actually had anything to do with that coup. I think that's okay. Just a rather vocal, if unconvincing, bit of Turkish propaganda that everyone has just played along with so as not to anger Erdogan. In fact, the Russian president, when asked about it a couple of years ago, when asked about their responsibility for the coup, his comments were pretty much to the point of, if Erdogan says that's what happened, who am I to say otherwise?
Mark Sloboda, man, thank you so much. I always appreciate you carving out the time for me and for the show that you do. Mark Sloboda, really appreciate you joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
And folks, thank you all so much for listening to the Connecting the Dots podcast with me, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Stay tuned for new episodes every week. Also, please, please, please follow and subscribe. Leave a review, share the show. We're growing tremendously, but we can only grow as you allow us to. Follow us on social media. You can find all the links below in the show description. And remember, folks, that this is where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge, because talk without analysis is just chatter, and we do not chatter on Connecting the Dots. See you again next time. Until then, I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Have a great one. Peace. We're out.
Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon, where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge.